1450 AM, 103.5 FM. And we're also streaming online at our website, BighornMountainRadio.com. You can get us anywhere, anytime on the web. I'm Brady Safranik, and joining me now, Christina Schmidt, Public Information Specialist with Wyoming Game and Fish Department. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning.
We're going to talk about a handful of things here this morning, but for about a week now, the over-the-counter leftover licenses and general licenses have been on sale.
Correct. They went on sale beginning the morning of the 13th at 8 a.m. So you can purchase your general license, and then also anything that was left over after the first two draws went on sale. And just to give folks a heads up, there are no pronghorn licenses left in the state. I've had quite a few calls at the office about that. They are actually sold out statewide. So there are
Is
no
that normal that that happens early?
You know, in the past few years, it has been, yeah. Years ago, it used to be that you could pick up some leftovers, but in recent years, those have become fewer and fewer. And then, of course, this year, we did reduce licenses in this area due to, of course, the drought conditions we've been dealing with for the past few years. Plus, we did have a disease outbreak last year in the fall of epizootic hemorrhagic disease. So there were some reductions, but it also has been trending that way for the past few years that those licenses are just getting picked up in the draws. So for everything else, you know, there are some cow-calf, some Dauphin licenses left over in the region. You can actually go online and from our homepage at the top, the apply or buy button, if you click on that, and on the right-hand side of the page, after you click on that button, it'll say leftover licenses, and you can click on that, and it's updated in real time because, of course, these are being sold all over the state, not just at the office or online, but also at license selling agents. So it is in real time. You can see statewide what's left, how many, which is pretty handy. So definitely take a look at that. I would caution folks for sure. A lot of these leftover licenses have restrictions on them. For example, they might be private land only, or there might be, you know, a geographic restriction on where you can use them. So before you purchase anything, we really encourage folks, see what's available, then go look at the regulations for what type that license is, and see if that is something you're able to do, you know, especially with private land only. You know, before you purchase the license, make sure you've lined somewhere up
have
to go
plan,
hunt.
Right?
Yeah, have a plan. So
can't just sit in your backyard and pick things off.
Yeah.
Well, in most people's backyard.
Most people can't. Correct. Most people cannot do that. So, you know, before you spend the money to get one, line something up first. You know, make some calls, go visit with folks, see if you have somewhere to actually use that license. So, those are available. Along those lines, our hunter management area permission slips also the day after on July 14th, those opened up for folks to get slips. And so the hunter management area is a part of our Access Yes program. And so we have the walk-in areas, which I think a lot of people are familiar with. So for both of these programs, these are tracts of private land where the landowner has entered into an agreement with Game and Fish to allow public hunting. There are restrictions on both places. The landowner, you know, within the season can set, you know, this what species they would allow to be hunted, you know, any specific dates, locations within the property. Again, trying to give them maximum flexibility on, you know, how it runs on their property. And then it's a great opportunity for hunters. So for walk-in areas, like it sounds, you can just walk in. You don't have to get permission. You don't have to go ask the landowner. It's just open. Read the rules. Make sure you're following what is laid out for that specific property. But then you can just walk in. Hunter management areas are a bit different. You do have to have a permission slip, and these are available online. First come, first serve basis. So again, those opened up on the 14th. The one thing, it's pretty intuitive to go through the process. However, you do need to actually have a license purchased before you can get a permission slip. So I was on the phone with a gentleman a couple of days ago who said, hey, I'm trying to get my permission slip. It's not letting me do anything. I can't see. And I'm thinking, what is going on? And then we discovered he hadn't actually purchased a license yet.
Okay.
And so with our new Game and Fish account, so everyone has an actual sports person account, when you purchase your license, a general license or limited quota one, it actually has that in the system. So once you do that and you go in to apply for a permission slip, it's going to automatically pull up what license you have and say, oh, here are the HMAs that are available to you. So it's really helpful and handy. Just make sure you do purchase that license first. Otherwise, it's not going to show you any options and you won't be able to proceed any further. So you'll log in with your sports person ID. You can go through the process. You do need to have a pretty good idea of the dates that you want and also be able to enter vehicle information, just because that's going to all be printed on your permission slip. You know, hey, I'll be driving this color truck with this license plate, that kind of thing. So, and each property has its own ranch rules, and we really encourage folks, just like the walk-in areas, read these ranch rules. Some of them are quite specific, maybe even a restriction like maybe archery only or something like that. Make sure you read through those, know what is required on that property, and be willing and able to abide by it before you put in.
And so where do they get all that information? How can they find out about these areas and the specific rules?
Sure. Very easy. If you go to our homepage, there is, I believe the button is green at the very top that says public access. And when you click on that, it'll bring up walk-in areas for hunting, walk-in areas for fishing. Hunter management areas are one of them, and they're big blocks. So you click on that, and it'll actually bring up a statewide map of all of them in the state. You can zoom in to the area you're interested in, and there will be a name for each hunter management area. If you click on that, it'll bring up just a real small box that gives you just real basic information like species and date and things like that. But if you hit more info, it takes you to another page and it zooms in nicely, a big map of the area. You can see, you know, a lot of detail. In the ranch rules, you'll be able to see that. And lots of resources to help you kind of see which one's going to be the best fit for you, depending on the license you have. But if you hit that public access tab, go to the hunter management block, and tons of information you can get.
So the hunter's responsible for knowing who owns what land, whose land they're on, where they are. I mean, they need to do some research before they just grab a gun and go out.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do try to make that as easy as possible for folks with these maps. These are really interactive. You can put different layers on. You can print them out. You can download them to your phone. We really try to make it easy for folks to have somewhere to hunt, and be able to follow the rules so that we can keep these properties. So the Hunt Planner is another really great place. So you can certainly, like I said, go directly to the hunter management areas. But if you go to our Hunt Planner, there's a lot of other tools there. But for sure, knowing where you are, property boundaries, all of that is of the utmost importance.
Well, in these days, I mean, you can do it the old-fashioned way and break out the maps and all that sort of thing. And for some people, that's fun to do. But for others, they're jumping into the 21st century and they've got those digital GPS and they can carry it around. You see right where you are. And
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you can certainly carry that in the field. Again, you can take old-fashioned maps. I like paper maps myself, but you can take those. Have both. You know, that's a really good thing, too.
I kind of like both because I'm a little nostalgic in the way that I like paper maps. But boy, when you're, you know, out and about and you find a spot and you can just click a button and it marks that spot for you and you can come back, you know, just, oh, well, take me back to that spot. You know, it makes it pretty easy to get around. And, you know, I've even used that fishing. You know, you find a spot on a lake you really like and you click that little button, you know, whether it's your fish finder or whatever. And it just helps you to get back to that that same spot you were at before.
Yeah, there's some pretty amazing tools out there. So certainly encourage folks to use those and, you know, watch signs. A lot of these walk-in areas and hunter management areas, our folks do a really good job trying to sign along boundaries as best we can to say, hey, here's the boundary, here's that. So pay attention to signs. Certainly pay attention when you pull into the parking area. You know, there's any, you know, new information that may have arisen, some of the rules, things like that. Pay attention to those signs when you pull in. See if there's anything you need to learn right then and there. And then as you go out onto the property, keep an eye out for signs. We do try to fence those boundaries so to help people stay where they're supposed to be.
And respect the property. Don't leave trash behind, that sort of thing, because that's when landowners are going to be like, well, maybe I shouldn't open this up.
Exactly. You know, common courtesy, you know, don't leave trash. If you find some, pick it up. Gates, don't leave them open. If you come across one that's open, you're not sure if it should be or not, maybe try to get in contact with the landowner, or if you don't know who it is, maybe even contact the local warden or biologist. Say, hey, I came across this. You know, maybe it's supposed to be open. Maybe someone else left it open and it's not supposed to be. So if you open a gate, close it. If one's open, maybe, you know, see if it, if something needs to be remedied. You know, careful where you park, you know, all that kind of stuff that's just common courtesy when you're on someone else's property.
And we've learned that since we were kids, right? Or some of us have, that, you know, leave something looking better than it was when you got there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a great opportunity that these landowners have provided, and certainly want to make sure that it's a good experience for everyone.
Absolutely. So coming up here on July the 29th, there's going to be a public fence pull up near Elgin Park, which is just up Highway 16 there up the mountain. What is a public fence pull?
So this is actually pretty neat. They've done this you know, in a few places around here and over on the western side of the state. My gosh, when I lived in Jackson 20 years ago, they were doing fence pulls. And basically, it's people who come together, identify areas where there's maybe downed fence, unnecessary fence, and remove it. Also, modification of fences to make them more wildlife friendly. So the whole point of this is to prevent wildlife, livestock, anything getting tangled up in fences that either don't need to be there or could be modified to make it easier for those animals to get over or under. And so there's actually a new initiative forming here in the Bighorns, and we had a kickoff meeting, and it was really great. Lots of people, lots of different organizations representing different interests, but with a common goal. So it was really great. Lots of people interested in making the landscape more wildlife friendly in terms of fences, you know, making sure those fences contain livestock like they should, but allow wildlife movement too. And so basically this group is starting to identify some places on the mountain. Some even, I know one of the groups in Sheridan has a focus too on private land as well, trying to, you know, identify areas where fence can be removed or fence can be modified. That's a lot of work, right? Fencing is a lot of work.
Fencing is work.
Either way, whether you're removing it or modifying it. And so this is a way that people can come out and help. And my gosh, you get a bunch of volunteers, and yeah, it's
more
hot,
people,
hard work.
It goes,
but,
right?
But yeah, you know, it's a lot of fun to get together with people who are, you know, doing something really beneficial on the landscape and for wildlife. So there will be one on the 29th. Which is a Friday, so I know, you know, it's a work day. A lot of people can't make it. But for those who are interested and would like to go, they're going to meet at the Forest Service office here at 8:30 and caravan
people
up.
People can just tell their boss, Game and Fish needs me today.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so, yeah, there's going to be, I think, quite a crew going up. They've identified a spot where they're going to actually, I guess, do removal. And so, and if you can't make it, this is just the first one. There's going to be more. We do ask if folks are interested in coming to this one. The Mule Deer Foundation actually has kind of a sign-up page just to help us keep track of volunteers who are signing up so we know how many to expect. So if you go to muledeer.org, O-R-G, if you go to events and chapters, this is listed as an event. You can click on that. It'll give you all the details of where and when. what to bring, which of course is going to be, you know, gloves. I think snacks and water are going to be provided, but certainly maybe bring some more of your own.
Closed-toe shoes or
closed-toe
boots.
Closed-toe shoes.
Don't show up in flip-flops.
Hat, sunscreen. You know, it's outdoor work. Yeah. You know, everything you would need to be prepared to be outdoors for several hours doing, you know, pretty...
Fun stuff.
You know, it's hard. I think it's hard work, but, you know, it's really a great thing to get that stuff off the landscape when it's no longer needed and not functioning as it should. So, yeah, great opportunity there. And also, certainly, if folks are interested, we'll advertise more as they come up to either, you know, go in and remove some of these or just modify them. It makes a huge difference just to modify the fences a bit where animals can get over or under more easily. It really makes a huge difference just adjusting some of those fence heights a few inches, you know.
Or even, you know, because I've seen, you know, antelope, you know, deer, they'll easily jump over. An antelope can jump over, but sometimes I'll see them just charge right at the fence and try and go through it. And, you know, so sometimes just modifying, maybe making a little more space between the two wires will allow them to get through. Because the one, I'm thinking of one specific instance where this thing just, it was caught on the in between the two sides of the road. There was fence on either side, and it was just running back and forth as I'm coming behind it. So I kind of slowed down and backed off, and then it just charged towards one side. And just it made it through, but it wasn't pretty.
Oh, yeah, it's awful. And I think we've all seen... you know, animals caught in fences, and it's really awful. It's really horrible. And for pronghorn specifically, like you said, they're not jump. They can jump. They just don't really. They prefer to go under. That's what they do. And in areas where they're trying to get pronghorn movement, just replacing the bottom wire with smooth wire instead of barbed, and raising it at least 16 inches above the ground gives them the space to slide right under. It's pretty amazing. We've got actually some pretty great footage. One of our biologists got down by Casper of a large group moving through that encountered a fence, and it was wildlife friendly, and one by one they just slipped under. It's really effective. It actually works. So just making, again, some small modifications like that, raising that bottom wire, making sure it's smooth instead of barbed, you know, it'll still contain livestock, but it's more permeable for wildlife.
And so if people want to help out, again, that's July 29th, going to be near Elgin Park. And it looks like people are going to meet at the Buffalo Forest Service office at 8:30 that morning and then just kind of caravan up.
Right. Right. Yep. And make sure to sign up again, muledeer.org under events, just so we have a number to anticipate.
And about how long will they be working into the day?
You know, it depends on how many people, you know, you have a lot of people, it goes faster for sure. But I would say probably at least through lunch, early afternoon.
Okay. So most of the day, a full
probably,
work day.
Probably most of the day. Yeah. And again, bring stuff that'll keep you comfortable up there while you work.
And lately it's been hot and dry, and, you know, that makes for good fire conditions, not good fire. I don't know how you exactly say that. Higher elevated fire danger.
Risk, yeah.
There you go. It's not really good. But so there's some fire bans in place.
Correct. So for game and fish properties, so, you know, the Game and Fish Commission owns or administers several properties in the area. Kind of the big ones that most people are going to be familiar with are like the Bud Love, the Edo Taylor, Amsden, Kearns, Tongue River Canyon public access area. And so we follow county bans. And, of course, counties have been implementing fire bans pretty regularly in the past week, 2 weeks. So Johnson County, theirs is in effect currently. And so for game and fish properties in Johnson County, no fires. And for Crook County and Sheridan County, that just came out yesterday, Sheridan County, and again, we follow. So for properties in Sheridan and Crook counties, that ban actually begins July 22nd at 8 a.m. So that's, you know, one of the big places, Tongue River Canyon public access area. There's some camping spots. There are established fire rings. And even when there's not a fire ban, you still are required to keep them within those rings. But with this ban, now there just will be no fires allowed. Just too risky. You know, these wildlife habitat management areas were purchased, you know, decades ago specifically for winter range for wildlife, you know, elk and deer. And to have a fire, a late season fire, and lose a lot of that forage going into the winter is pretty devastating. So we really, you know, we work hard to keep invasive weeds out, to keep the landscape healthy for these animals in the winter. And a fire would really be pretty catastrophic. So we try to be very cautious.
So some people, you know, when they hear fire bans, they might get a little annoyed, but it's for the best, you know.
It is, yeah. And like you said, the risk, you know, with these hot temperatures, you know, we had good rain this spring. We had good grass growth, and now everything is drying out. It's so hot and dry.
It's not pretty and green anymore. Now it's burnt brown.
Yeah, and the wind and everything. It's just, yeah, conditions have changed for sure.
Yeah. So lions and tigers and bears, oh my, maybe not tigers so much, but there has been some bears in the area. One actually had to be put down near Story recently.
Correct. Yeah. You know, every year, you know, bears are out and about. We live in bear habitat for sure, all along the foothills, the mountains, pretty much all of Johnson County, Sheridan County. You know, there's the potential for a bear. They move around. It's good bear habitat. They're always looking for food. And we really need the public's help in keeping food, unnatural foods, out of the reach of bears. We have had quite a few conflicts in different places this summer already. Yeah, for sure, Story. But, you know, Bighorn, Dayton, Ranchester, outside of Buffalo, you know, there's bears. And so really asking people to keep trash picked up, that's a big one. You know, if your trash gets picked up on a Tuesday morning, keep it inside the garage, in a shed, some hard-sided building until the morning of pickup. Don't leave it out. You know, don't put it out on Sunday and let it sit there till Tuesday. It's, you know, not just bears, but you don't want a raccoon getting in it or a skunk or the neighbor's dog, anything else, right? It's just kind of messy. So trash, bird feeders is a big one for sure. Seeds, either bird seed or suet or nectar out of hummingbird feeders, all of that is really high calorie, really attractive to bears.
Probably some stuff people don't think about the bird feeder. You know, they'll think more about something that would be a little bigger meal for a bear.
Yeah, exactly. But it's calorie dense, and so it's good stuff, and they like it. So, and I understand people want to feed birds. I get it. You know, I like to as well. But you can mitigate that. You can, you know, keep it out of the reach of bears. Maybe put just a tiny bit of food in at a time. Don't fill it up, you know. So eat just a small amount that the birds are going to eat up very quickly. Yeah, you have to go out and refill it regularly. It takes a lot more work.
It's better than walking out and there's being a bear.
It's better than having a bear. So, you know, have just a very tiny bit of food out there that they're not going to make a mess and have a lot of leftovers. But really, the best thing to do, hang it. You know, hang it at least, you know, 8-10 feet off the ground and away from like a tree trunk so a bear can't get up and get it. So you can still feed the birds. You can still see the birds. But a bear is not going to get it. And backyard domestic livestock. We're seeing a lot of conflicts with that. So backyard chickens, beehives, people keep goats, rabbits, you know, things like that, which is great. But keep in mind, you know, those are going to be attractants for a bear, both in terms of maybe the animals themselves, you know, contained within a coop, or the feed. You know, a lot of people have, you know, you got chicken scratch, you got, you know, all these things that you may have sitting right by the coop to make it easy to feed. Even though that's not appealing stuff to us, for a bear, again, a good, nice, high-calorie meal is how they see it. So please, again, make sure that's in a hard-sided building. Keep it somewhere where bears can't get to it. And for protecting the animals themselves, if you go to bearwise.org, there's actually some really good diagrams on electric fencing and fencing out, you know, especially for beehives. You know, that it's a great way to protect your hives, keeps the bears out. It's non-lethal, but it certainly discourages them. There's all kinds of different tools. There's what they call unwelcome mats, which are kind of mats with an electric charge. So
Just said go away.
No. Yeah. So there's a lot of creative ways to protect your animals and keep bears safe as well. Definitely do a little research. Again, it's great people keep these things, but be mindful. A bear may be interested, and again, we want to keep all that stuff out of the reach of bears.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things about that, not just that the bears can come down into your yard, but if they get used to it, then they have to do what they had to do in story, and they have to euthanize the bear.
Exactly. So bears naturally are afraid of people, right? However, if they come around people and get a food reward, they start to realize that it's worth the risk to be around people, right? Hey, I had to be around some people, but I was able to get, you know, the leftovers of some ice cream out of their trash or whatever it is. And it just changes that bear's behavior. It changes their temperament. They're going to be what we call food conditioned or habituated, where they are used to people. It doesn't bother them to be around people, which is not natural, because that risk-reward balance has shifted. And it's not as risky because they're getting a pretty good reward. And it's hard to break that. Once a bear figures that out, that it's okay to be around people, and then even start defending that as a food resource, you know, whatever they're finding, it just creates a really bad situation, a potential human safety concern, and it's not good. So the other thing we ask people to do is, if they do have a bear conflict, call us right away. Again, habituation is this process. So unfortunately, we see people, a bear gets into the trash one day, and then another day, and another day, and another day, and they're tired of picking it up, and then they call us. Well, the bear's been getting into trash for a week or two, and you know, then management
call
options.
Call after day one.
Call after day one. There are more management options when it's like the one-time, first-time incident. Once a pattern has been established, it's hard to
break that.
It's tough to break that. Even, you know, people say, well, just relocate them. But once they have it in their head that being around people is a source of food, wherever you move them, you're either putting them someplace. You know, there's no remote places anymore.
Yeah,
there's
going to be people somewhere.
There's going to be people somewhere. Or, like you said, they can travel pretty incredible distances coming back. Because, again, in their head, they know, hey, I can go here and find food. So it's a powerful attractor to come back. So if we can get to it really early, give us a call as soon as you think you have a problem. Get all your attractants picked up. A biologist or warden will come out, visit with you, see what happened, and make a plan.
Okay. And we're going to talk a little bit about watercraft registrations. And before we get into what you have here, I kind of have a question based on something personal. So I recently bought, and the question is, how do you know when your flotation device, your boat of some kind, needs to be registered? And I say that because we all know a big motorboat needs to be registered. So I just bought this one-person inflatable pontoon. And it's got a HIN on it. For those of you who don't know, it's the hull identification number. So I'm assuming that means I have to get that registered.
Does it have a motor?
Well,
are you going to use a motor?
I'm probably going to put an electric trolling motor.
There you
on
go.
It.
Yeah, and funny you say that, because I actually had this question yesterday. So I help out with the watercraft registrations here and there, and we get a lot of these kinds of questions. What do I need? What not? So, first off, if you have any specific questions, give a call to the regional office. We'll let you know for sure what you need. But pretty much every watercraft is going to need that aquatic invasive species decal. Okay, so that is, there's motorized and non-motorized. You can buy it for 1 year or 3 year. So there's that. Pretty much all watercraft are going to need that. There are a few exceptions. You can read in the regulations and see where your item fits. Mostly you're going to need that. For actual registrations, yeah, I had a gentleman come in yesterday. He said, hey, mine's inflatable. He did not have a HIN, but he was planning to put a trolling motor on it. At that point, it is motorized. you would need registration.
Okay. So anything motorized needs registration.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. And it
so
does.
So if I just took mine out with the oars, I'd be okay?
Well, no, not necessarily. I don't have the regulations sitting in front of me, but I would say anything like that, call and ask. Call and ask for sure. I do know if you have something motorized, for sure you are.
Okay.
And the person yesterday actually didn't have a hen, and they were having to go to the courthouse. You just take documentation of, like, here's my receipt and paperwork of what I have. They'll actually get a hen for you, and then you can come and get it registered. So, okay. Yeah, there's all kinds of questions like that, and I would say give a call to the office because there's a lot of kind of unique situations like that. And
ignorance of the law is no excuse, right?
Yeah, and like I said, I should have brought my regulations, but I don't have them in front of me. But for sure, any question, give a call. We'll get you squared away on what you need and how to do all the paperwork. What we have had in the past few days, so first off, if you have a watercraft that needs to be renewed, you can do that online and save a trip. That's pretty easy. A lot of people have gotten a letter in the mail. Again, you can fill out that paperwork, send it back in. If you prefer to come into the office, you can certainly do that. And same with a new registration. You know, if you've purchased a new boat or it's just, you know, either brand new or new to you. We have an application either for the renewal or for a new registration, and it does require the actual original signature of the owner or co-owner. What we've seen in the past few days, people coming in, hey, I need to register this for my dad or, you know, my husband or whatever it is, but they don't have the original signed copy of the paperwork, and we do have to have that from either the owner or the co-owner. So once that's done, anyone could bring it in. You just can't come in and do it for someone else if you're not the owner or co-owner. So you can print out the application online, have the owner or co-owner sign it, bring in a copy of bring in the title, bring in a copy of sales tax paid. We'll get all of that registered and in the system and get you the stickers that you need. We've just had a few people who've made the trip up to renew or get a new registration for someone else, and we can't do that.
Wasted trip.
Yeah, we do have to have that original signature. So,
okay.
But again, if people have questions, call ahead for sure. We have great staff at the front desk who will tell you exactly what you need to bring, you know, hours that we're open, everything like that. And the number at the office is 672-7418.
All right. We're talking with Christina Schmidt, Public Information Specialist with Wyoming Game and Fish Department. Christina, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And everybody keep those radio dials tuned right here, KBBS.